In the long catalogue of 20th century political violence, few figures have travelled as far, crossed as many borders, or adopted as many identities as the man later called Carlos the Jackal. His name, which would eventually circulate through newspapers, courtrooms and intelligence briefings, belonged to Illich Ramirez Sanchez. This is his story. Welcome to History Unpacked. If you enjoy the content, consider subscribing. We post every week and we welcome any feedback. Born in October 1949 in Caracas, Venezuela, into a family that encouraged political engagement from an early age, his father, a committed Marxist, named his sons after Lenin's given names. In this environment, radical ideas were not simply encountered but absorbed as part of everyday life. The story of how this young man from Venezuela became one of the most recognizable militants of the 1970s is not a single linear arc, but a sequence of movements between continents, quarters, and shifting alliances. It is a history shaped as much by the turbulent politics of the era as by the ambitions of a man who sought both purpose and influence in the clandestine world. When Illich left Venezuela in the mid-1960s, he entered an international movement defined by Cold War polarization. Student movements protested across campuses, post-colonial struggles emerged across Africa and the Middle East, and revolutionary ideas circulated freely. His education took him first to London and then to Moscow, where he was accepted into the Patrice Lumumba University, an institution known for training foreign students sympathetic to Marxist and anti-imperialist ideas. He remained there only briefly. Academic discipline did not interest him as much as political commitment, and he soon sought a more active role. By 1970, Sanchez had moved to Lebanon and made contact with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP, a Marxist faction involved in the Palestinian struggle. The PFLP's training camps offered not only ideological grounding, but a structured environment where operational skills could be developed. Weapons handling, guerrilla tactics, and the logistics of clandestine work. For the young Venezuelan, this was an opportunity to step from theory into action. He joined the organization and began operating under the name Carlos, a layer of anonymity required in militant circles, though one that would eventually become anything but anonymous. Throughout the early 1970s, Carlos served the PFLP as an international operative. Much of his work involved support tasks, securing safe houses, transporting material, and establishing connections amongst sympathetic networks in Europe. These roles, though not publicly visible, were essential to the movement's ability to operate beyond the Middle East. Yet Carlos desired a more direct role, one that would position him as an instrument of revolutionary pressure on Western governments. His first widely noted action came in 1973 when he attempted to assassinate Joseph Seif, a prominent British businessman and vice president of the Marks & Spencer's retail chain. Seif, known for his support of Israel, became a target for the PFLP. The attack, however, did not unfold as planned. Carlos managed to enter the Seif residence in London, but the weapon malfunctioned and Seif survived. British authorities immediately began searching for the assailant, but Carlos slipped back into the shadows of Europe's clandestine networks. This event did not elevate him to the status he expected, but it demonstrated his willingness to take risks far from the Middle Eastern front lines. In the following years, Carlos remained in Europe, frequently shifting locations. He circulated between Paris, Brussels, Frankfurt, and The Hague, sometimes under false passports, sometimes relying on the hospitality of sympathizers. The PFLP viewed him as useful but unpredictable, a talented operative whose ambition occasionally exceeded strategic priorities. Even so, he continued to receive assignments, including a series of planned attacks on targets linked to Israel or Western interests. Not all of these missions were carried out, yet they contributed to a pattern of activity that would, in time, place his name at the forefront of international counter-terrorism concerns. The turning point in Carlos's public recognition occurred in December 1975 in Vienna. There, at the headquarters of OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, the oil ministers of several major producing nations gathered for a conference expected to draw global attention. Amongst those present were ministers from Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Algeria, and Libya. The meeting represented a moment of high political tension. Global oil prices had reshaped international relationships, and OPEC leadership had become a focal point of diplomatic contention. Carlos and a small team of militants entered the building on 21st of December. They seized the conference room, killed three individuals during the initial assault, and took more than 60 hostages, including the oil ministers themselves. This operation immediately became one of the most significant international hostage crises of the decade. Carlos announced that their demand was the release of a group of Palestinian prisoners and the publication of a political declaration. Yet the motivations behind the attack were complex, entangled in both internal PFLP politics and the interests of state that quietly supported military operations. The hostage situation continued for nearly 2 days. Under negotiated agreements, a plane was arranged to fly the ministers and militants to Algeria, which acted as a mediator. As the crisis unfolded, governments across the world issued statements, intelligence agencies scrambled for information, and newspapers reported the events continually. When the hostages were eventually released in Algiers, under circumstances that remain debated, Carlos became headline news. He had achieved the international visibility he had long pursued, not as a symbolic revolutionary figure, but as a central actor in a major geopolitical incident. After Vienna, Carlos's position with the PFLP grew unstable. The organization was uneasy with the attention it had drawn, and some leaders disagreed with the way the OPEC operation concluded. Nonetheless, Carlos continued to work independently, using his notoriety to forge networks across radical European groups such as the Red Army faction in Germany and the communist combat cells in Belgium. He assembled what he termed the Organization of Arab Armed Struggle, a loose collective of militants prepared to undertake operations on behalf of various political causes. During the late 1970s and early 1980s, a series of bombings and attacks across France and West Germany were attributed to Carlos's network. Amongst the most notable were the 1982 bombings in Paris, which targeted a train station and a newspaper office, causing multiple fatalities and injuries. French authorities linked these attacks to Carlos in retaliation for the arrest of two of his associates. The accuracy of some of these attributions remain a matter of historical scrutiny, but the pattern of activity ensured that his name remained synonymous with international terrorism. By the mid-1980s, however, the global political landscape began to shift. States that had previously hosted or tolerated Carlos's presence now reconsidered their positions. The Cold War's ideological fervor was diminishing, and governments, particularly in the Middle East and Eastern Europe, sought to distance themselves from militant groups that had once regarded as useful instruments of influence. Carlos found fewer safe havens and increasingly relied on states facing their own internal pressures. After leaving Europe, he lived for several years in Syria under government protection before moving to Sudan in the early 1990s. By this point, his influence had significantly declined. He no longer commanded a network of operatives, nor did he possess the ability to shape international events. Instead, he existed as a relic of another political era, still dangerous, still wanted, but increasingly isolated. In 1994, Sudan, responding to diplomatic pressures and shifting regional alliances, agreed to assist France in securing Carlos's capture. French intelligence agents, with Sudanese cooperation, entered his residence in Khartoum, sedated him, and transported him to Paris for trial. The event marked the end of his decades-long movement across borders and the beginning of a long legal process. Carlos was convicted in 1997 for the murder of two French police officers and an informant in 1975, an incident that had occurred during his early operations in Paris. He received a life sentence. In subsequent trials, he faced additional convictions for attacks carried out in the 1980s. Throughout these proceedings, he presented himself as a committed revolutionary, portraying his actions as part of an ideological struggle rather than acts of terrorism. The courts rejected these justifications. His imprisonment in France marked a symbolic conclusion to a period of transnational militancy that had once commanded global attention. Yet the significance of his story extends beyond the individual. It provides insight into an era where revolutionary rhetoric, state interests, and clandestine networks intersected in complex ways. Carlos operated at a time when militant movements could secure training, funding, and safe passage through a patchwork of international relationships. Intelligence services hunted him, but political considerations often shaped how seriously governments pursued him. Today, the legacy of Carlos the Jackal is complicated. His actions resulted in numerous deaths, widespread fear, and prolonged hostilities between states and militant groups. The international climate in which he once operated has changed profoundly. Improved intelligence cooperation, new legal frameworks, and altered geopolitical priorities have reduced the space in which such figures might exist. The era of open state support for armed revolutionary movements has largely receded. Yet his story continues to attract attention because it raises enduring questions. How do individuals become entwined with transnational causes? To what extent do ideological convictions blend with personal ambition? And how do states react when non-state actors acquire the capacity to influence international affairs? For historians, Carlos remains a figure defined not by mystery but by movement, across borders, organizations, and political currents. His life charts the trajectory of a man shaped by ideological tensions of the Cold War, carried along by networks that once spanned continents, and ultimately confined by a world that had shifted beneath his feet. His actions left traces in archives and diplomatic cables, in news reports and court records. Through these, we can both observe the scale of his ambitions and the limits of the world he tried to navigate. In the end, the story of Carlos the Jackal reveals less about an extraordinary individual than about the historical forces that enabled him. He was a product of ideological conflict, international fragmentation, and a climate in which political violence was often perceived by some as a legitimate instrument. Yet as the decades passed, that climate changed, and in the space he once occupied, that narrowed until nothing remained but the courtroom and the cell.